This is Eleanor Swent interviewing Frank Joklik in Salt Lake City, Utah, on October 18th, 1993. All right, now I think we're in business. All right, Frank, we've had a couple of mishaps here with a late plane and a couple of other things, but I think we're ready to settle down now. This is just beginning our interview, and I'd like to begin at the beginning. Here we are in Salt Lake on a beautiful October day, but we have to go back to your beginnings, which were in 1928 in Vienna. You want to start the story there?
Yes, let me reminisce a little bit about that.
A long ways away.
Yeah, but you know, here in Salt Lake, what I tend to be totally associated with, of course, is Kennicott and the recent years of Kennicott. But we go back, the trail leads back from there and begins in Vienna on May 30th, 1928, which is the year, which is my birth date there. And the first 9 years of my life were in Vienna, and I have nothing but very pleasant, warm recollections of those years. My parents, of both of whom I was very fond indeed, spent most of their lives in Vienna. And I should really talk just a little bit about who they were and mm-hmm. where they came from.
Please do.
My father's people came from a long line of military people.
What was your father's name?
His name was Karl.
With a K.
With a K, of mm-hmm. course. Karl Friedrich. And at the time of my birth, he was employed in Vienna by Siemens as an electrical engineer.
Siemens is not an Austrian company, is it?
No, it's a German company, but they had an Austrian affiliate called Siemens Schuckert. Siemens-Schuckert, S-C-H-U-C-K-E-R-T. My father was born in a town which is about 30 kilometers, I believe, from Vienna, which is called Pressburg, P-R-E-S-S-B-U-R-G. Better known now as Bratislava, which is now the capital of the recently formed Slovak Republic. And
that's only 30 kilometers from Vienna.
That's about all it is, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And as I say, he himself was brought up in a naval academy, and his father, whom I knew, was an army officer, and.
No, you said naval academy.
That's what I said.
Okay.
I know pretty well what I'm talking.
Yeah, I'm just.
Well, you may recall that Austria, in those days, at the time my father was born, Vienna was the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which of course had a big frontage on the Mediterranean Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, there was such a thing as an Austrian Navy.
Yes.
And he entered Naval Academy at age, quite a young age, either 8 or 9, and was brought up in a fairly strict mode till he graduated. Not long before the First World War. He was born in 1893, mm-hmm. so at the outbreak of the First World War, he was 21, and he had just been graduated as a junior naval officer, mm-hmm. and pretty much got into action in the Mediterranean in the First World War, and of course, I suppose the main battles during that war were with the between the Austrian and the Italian Navy. After the war, of course, which Austria was on the losing side, mm-hmm. the Navy ceased to exist because Austria became a landlocked nation. So he decided to go back to school, mm-hmm. and he enrolled in the Technical University in Vienna and graduated subsequently in electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. And upon his graduation, he joined Siemens. And that's what he was doing at the time of my birth.
Interesting.
On my mother's side, she was born in a relatively small town called Mährisch-Trübau. I'll spell that M-A-H, M-A umlaut H, R-I-S-C-H, Trübau. That's T-R-U umlaut B-A-U. And that has a Czech name now, which frankly I couldn't tell you approximately what it's called. Mm-hmm. But her maiden name was Giesel, G-I-E-S-S-L, which was a German farmer's name. I mean, farmers, apostrophe in, in that area, and had been for hundreds of years in the vicinity of that town. And the Giesels had farmed there. I mean, you can trace it back to the, even now, to the early 18th century, mm-hmm. On the same property.
Right.
The only thing is that her father did not follow the farming tradition. He got into academic pursuits, and he became the headmaster of the local high school there. Mm. That's what he was when my mother was born in Mährisch-Trübau in 1996, I believe.
And
1896.
And what was her name?
Helene. My mother's name was Helene.
H-E-L-E-N-E.
H-E-L-E-N-E. Mm-hmm. Louise, L-O-U-I-S-E. Mm-hmm. Adele.
Oh my.
A-D-E-L-E. Those were, that's her full name. So she was born in Mährisch-Trübau in 1896. And went to school there, and then went to high school, I believe, in Brunn, B-R-U-N-N, B-R-U-Umlaut, N-N, which is now called Brno, B-R-N-O, and is the biggest, the second biggest city in the current Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to Vienna to attend the Teachers Academy there in Vienna. And that's where she met my father when he embarked on his engineering career there. So they got married in Vienna. Doesn't say on my birth certificate when they were married. I can look that up.
Probably around 1920 or so, 22 maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Early 20s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in 1937, my father left Siemens to join an Austrian steel company, the English translation of which would be Styrian, S-T-Y-R-I-A-N, Steelworks. In German, Steirische Gusstahlwerke.
Okay.
And at the same time, he entered into a contract with them to go to Australia and establish sales offices in Sydney and Melbourne.
Let me just quickly, you said that you have a brother.
Okay. My brother is a year and a half older than me.
I see. So he was also born in Vienna.
He was born in Vienna also, exactly. And he and I were and are very close.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to give his name?
Yeah. His first name is Wolfgang, just like Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
Wolfgang Karl.
Okay.
His first name. And he, of course, is a very distinguished personage now. He is he's just retired as chairman of microbiology at Duke University, plus all kinds of other very high academic honors, member of the National Academy of Sciences, and science, I mean. Unquestionably one of the two or three leading virologists in this country.
My.
Is my brother. He just retired, I think, last year, and at his retirement dinner, I forget how many there were, there was quite a clutch of Nobel Prize winners came from all parts of the world to attend the occasion.
My.
To honor him. So that is the sort of family setting which we can come back to, but that's the outline. Well,
very distinguished family.
Well, thank you. My parents were both very, very bright. I think I'm the black sheep of the family.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway, at the time of my birth, my parents lived right in Vienna, in the city, a large apartment, which I remember very fondly. It was a large apartment with maid's quarters and all the rest of that, and there was a live-in maid with whom my brother and I had a relationship of respect when respect was due, and when no one was looking, perhaps a little less than respect. But anyway, it worked. It worked all right. Anyway. Mm-hmm. We went to school in a public school, which was also a teacher's academy, and I suppose in retrospect one would say that the teaching was of a very high standard, and the discipline was quite strict.
Mm-hmm.
There was strong emphasis on academic performance, and no one, neither the students nor the parents of students, questioned that. It mm-hmm. wouldn't have occurred to anyone to question it. My brother was always a year ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And we both did well at school. We both were always at the top of our class. And
I would guess you didn't have much choice in that.
In what?
Your parents probably expected you to be at the top, didn't they?
Well, but there was choice, sure, academic performance was expected, but not only of us, it was expected of all the uh-huh. kids in the school. I mean, it was not considered negative
no.
to perform academically. That was the atmosphere. And this doesn't mean by any means that the kids were always at their books mm-hmm. or that they were terribly serious or anything, because I think I was in a class of 25. I was very close friends with most of them. We used to play both just games but also sports, mm-hmm. particularly soccer and gymnastics.
Was this a boys' school?
Oh, yes.
Yes. But we need to say
I'll say. Oh, yeah. I don't think there were any mixed schools in those days anywhere in the country.
So basic classical curriculum?
Yeah, starting from scratch, mm-hmm. and when we left, I had completed, I'd completed 4 years of school. But no languages at school yet,
mm-hmm.
at that stage. But my brother and I, our parents gave us private lessons in English from about the second or third grade.
Was this a common thing?
I know that some of my friends also had English instruction.
It's very interesting.
But I think, my parents were fairly enlightened in that regard. I think the normal thing would have been to wait for French,
mm-hmm.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, my father, who is pretty worldly, recognized, he had a bit of a vision of the future, recognized that English would be a very important language worldwide. And so we had those English lessons even before his appointment to Steyr and Steelworks.
Did he also know through. English?
Some, uh-huh. But not. He wasn't fluent.
No. And your mother?
Well, she spoke very good French,
mm-hmm.
But little English.
Mm. It's very interesting when you consider the position of a defeated military officer to learn the language of his victor. That's
international business,
mm-hmm.
is certainly the international business certainly required knowledge of languages,
mm-hmm.
and as I say, his main protagonists the First World War had been, I think, the Italians. And the French,
uh-huh.
But I don't think he ever came in contact with any English armed forces.
But they were on the opposite sides. That's interesting. It shows some breadth of thought, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, sure. But anyway, as I say, the childhood there in Vienna was one of a tremendous sense of security, direction, mm-hmm. and parental care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were really very, very important. And
what about music? One immediately thinks of music in Vienna.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's another thing. Yes, I started piano lessons at age 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I quickly determined that I didn't have much talent, that I was a minority of one. So my brother and I took piano lessons. Yes.
Maybe. All right, we're starting after a short break here.
Yeah, the piano lessons continued until the age of revolt, I think, which was at, I forget how old I was, maybe 13 or 14 years old, when I could plead pressure of other activities,
mm-hmm.
that didn't allow sufficient time to practice. So, as I say, I think my brother did a bit better than I do, but I determined that although I love music, it's one of my avocations, that manual dexterity on the keyboard is not one of my attributes, and I think that caused the whole program in the end to founder. As I think I've already indicated, this was a boys' school we attended, and of course all boys in the classroom, and then frankly all boys in the extracurricular activities, and I have to admit that my knowledge of the world of girls really was a fairly closed book to me until, for quite some time, because even in Australia then we went to a boys' school, of course. And,
what kind of clothes did you wear to school?
It was, there wasn't a school uniform. But I'm trying to think what it was. I was still in short pants,
of course.
Mm-hmm. Short pants and a shirt and a jacket.
Tie, I suppose.
Ties in the wintertime. I don't think ties in the summertime.
Cap?
No. In the winter when it got cold, a cap. But I mean, it wasn't a school uniform.
No uniform.
Cap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think some special memories that I have of those days was the very supportive environment in the school, where the where one's form master, although strict, was extremely interested to ensure that that kids didn't fall through a sort of a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that particularly one evening when I was asked in front of a audience of mostly parents to recite a poem, because my brother had developed the flu, and even though he was a year ahead of me, I was asked by his form master whether I would like to do it for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I said yes and learnt it, but getting up on a stage in front of an audience of maybe 100, 200 fond parents was still something that I wasn't very comfortable with.
No.
And I remember getting up there, and I certainly didn't have any memory lapse. And afterwards, my parents asked me why I started grinning halfway through it and kept on grinning. Well, the reason for that was very simply that this form master had of my brothers had placed himself in the front row, and as I was sort of, you know, struggling with my memory perhaps a little bit, he was sitting there with a big grin on his face, sort of directing my performance, as if I was singing something. And I thought that was hilarious, and almost, you know, almost laughed out loud. But that was just an illustration that it was at the same time a you know, a pretty rapid learning curve in the school, but it, also a very caring sort of environment.
Mm-hmm.
In the evenings, we'd do our homework, and I always have the memory that in the drawing room to which my parents retired after dinner, the routine was always the same, that my mother would play the piano, and she was an excellent pianist, which somehow I didn't inherit. And my father would be reading newspapers or a book or whatever, and there was always a box of chocolates on the drawing room table, and occasionally my brother and I would sneak in and be invited to partake thereof.
Oh,
but
no.
Going to sleep by the sound of my mother playing the piano was always very something I
sounds
remember
like
very
a
clearly, yeah.
Delightful memory.
Yeah. On weekends, apart from any organized sports, organized by the school or school excursions, we used to do a lot of excursions. Hiking seemed to be what everybody did on weekends, where either by car or by train you'd go a little distance outside the city and then hike on very well-marked trails through the forests and the mountains and the hills. And I'm amazed by some of the distances that I'm aware of now that we as little kids used to cover with our parents. It was almost a, you know, the standard procedure that on nice summer days you'd, or weekends you'd go out. Sometimes they had it organized that you could, you know, if you had a, particularly if you had a pack sack, that you could stay overnight at an inn and then come back again to the train head or whatever and come in for Sunday evening. So,
how far were you walking? 10 miles?
Well, I sort of 18 kilometers, which is wasn't unusual in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a lot for little boys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't necessarily always done with the greatest enthusiasm, but it certainly taught us to A, a little stamina, and B, admiring the beauties of Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very, lovely childhood.
Important part of our lives. Well, then we should talk just a little bit about summer vacations, and they were usually taken in the mountains or at some lake in some other part of Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would come for a couple of weeks. We'd go, say, for 6 weeks or so. And my father would come for a couple of weeks and then on weekends from Vienna. Yeah, come in, please.
Okay.
I remember really even now just about every one of the places where we went for vacations, and they were always times of great, great pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end of summer, we'd go to Mährisch Trübau on the farm, which was run not by my grandfather, because he was the school principal, the headmaster. Mm-hmm. It was run by a man who'd married my mother's aunt, and he was a wonderful guy who was a huge guy. He had been again a military man. He'd been a colonel in the first.
Forget the tapes about Renat. So we may have lost just a little bit. So your uncle or your aunt's husband was a huge guy who.
Well, my great aunt's husband was this.
Yeah. Okay.
Huge guy named. We called him Uncle Hans, and he had a terrific sense of humor too, and was given to practical jokes of various kinds, which not only on my brother and me perhaps, but also my parents sometimes.
Mm.
He was a very funny man. But we would help with plowing or loading hay, and we're just going in the forest and gathering mushrooms and so on. So every summer we used to spend a couple of weeks there, and those were always highlights of the summer too. Those were very, very pleasant memories.
Sounds
of those
delightful.
Areas. And incredibly enough, a few weeks ago when my wife and I, after our IOC meeting in Monte Carlo, went to Prague for a few days, and just on the spur of the moment, one day we rented a car and drove the 200 odd kilometers east of Prague and visited that town again.
Hmm.
And
had you been back in the meantime?
No, possible.
First time back?
Would you? Yeah.
Hmm.
Couldn't.
No.
You know, just all behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
And frankly, I thought the town hadn't changed that much. Of course, you know, before the war, one third of the population of Czechoslovakia was German, and they all got expelled after the war, 3.5 million of them. And my uncle included, of course.
Mm.
And so it's all Czech now. And but I did find the old cemetery there where the Geisels were buried. But what had happened was that all the old graves had been sort of
plowed away to take to make place for new ones. Still a beautiful site with a with a 17th century church on it within the cemetery grounds, but it had obviously been closed up for decades and was a state of sad repair. So it was quite a evocative trip to go back there.
Were the houses there that you had been in? Did you?
Yeah, the house. main little city square was still there. Everything was pretty much intact.
Well,
but with the collectivization of the communist regime, essentially all farmhouses and most churches have been destroyed. With collectivization, everybody lives in these 3 and 4 foot concrete buildings that they are fond of erecting, and then the people who work the collective farms, I guess, live in those and then go out to the farms every day, rather than each farm sort of having its own home. But that was quite a trip, almost 60 years later.
Wonderful.
And we only had the one day to do it.
Mm-hmm. Must have been quite
poignant. Well, we congratulated ourselves, and Pam was very good at navigating, because, you know, there's no signs in English or German, everything's in Czech, and we don't know one word of Czech, and nevertheless, we made it, and we made some inquiries, and the people were, by and large, very helpful.
Didn't find any relatives.
Didn't find any relatives. No, the only thing that happened right towards the end of the day. No, all the relatives would have been expelled after the Second World War. But I was up in the cemetery, and there was this very elderly Czech gentleman, and he. I communicated with him pretty much through sign language, but he got the drift of what I wanted to do. And we had to get back to Prague that evening. It was about a 3-hour drive. By then it was already close to 6 o'clock, and we could recognize it was going to get dark in another half hour or hour. I wanted to leave the cemetery, and already had a couple of conversations with him, and he came over again and stopped me. And he pulled these car keys out of his pocket, said, inferred to me that he had this little car parked just outside the cemetery, and as near as I could gather, what he wanted to tell me was, look, let's go to some kind of recorders or registry office and check whether we can find anything there. And I thanked him very much, and I wish we'd had the time to do it, but I recognized by the time we got to the office, and it was very likely that they would have gone home anyway. Uh-huh. Found anyone else I could see another couple of hours or 3 hours maybe in that pursuit. So I just thanked him from the bottom of my heart, and we pressed on. Am I talking about it?
Yeah, we're doing fine.
Anyway, I don't know how we got sidetracked on. Oh yes, we were talking about the visits to Mary Strubau when we were little kids, and our recent recent visit back.
You mentioned the church. You might just say, were your family Roman Catholic?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So this was the church that they all went to.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely, but, well, I don't know, before the war they were associated with the town the size of Mary Strubau, there would have been dozens of churches, But I say quite a few of them were destroyed after the war, and this one was associated with the cemetery. So what I remember of it was that when we visited the cemetery on our visits there as a little boy, we used to go in the church and occasionally attend Easter services, particularly. Mm-hmm. Would be there at Easter.
So then your father left Siemens and went with this
with Styrian Steelworks, mm-hmm. Steirische Gusstahlwerke, to open these offices in Australia. And
he opened the offices there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. He signed the contract on the 2nd of December, 1937. I see in my notes here.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 1st of January, 1938, we left Vienna. And of course the events leading up to that were many, many parties and occasions with our relatives. Mm. Of course all on the assumption that we'd be back in 3 years.
Mm.
Nevertheless, quite serious because we were going to going right around the world.
Very far.
And there weren't any commercial airlines in those days. No. When it meant a long sea voyage, of course. So we said our fond farewells, and that I remember very clearly still. And the packers had come several days before, of course, and what we had to go with us, I mean to take physically on the trip was, I've got here one crate, two, you remember those big
steamer trunks?
Standing, what
steamer
were they
trunks.
Called? Steamer trunks, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Stood up
or
like this and you opened them up and could live out of them.
Right.
Two of those and then countless suitcases and so on and so forth. Plus eight large crates that were shipped separately, including the piano, the grand piano went, and everything went by ship separately.
Did you have any pets? Were there animals?
No. Fortunately, which would have made it so much more difficult, because Australia has some of the toughest quarantine laws in the world. And to get animals into Australia is very, very difficult. Quarantine periods in those days were 6 months or more.
Yeah.
So it was then on the 6th of January, 1938, we took the train to the South Railway Station, the Südbahnhof in Vienna, and the route was Venice, Rome, and Naples, where my brother and I had our first sight of the sea.
Wow.
And that was quite a thrill in itself. One of my...
You didn't see it at Venice?
No, it was night. Well, that's not quite true what I'm saying. We were awake and we saw a reflection in the moonlight, but it wasn't until the following day that we saw it in the daylight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we checked into a hotel there. We spent a day visiting Pompeii, and that I again can remember so clearly. And I could swear that Vesuvius was emitting quite a bit of smoke at that time, yeah. And then on the 9th of January, 3 p.m., the P&O liner, have you heard of the P&O
Certainly
liner?
Certainly have.
Yeah, the P&O liner Orion.
That's where the term posh came from, I think.
I don't know, was it?
I
really?
Think so. P&O, forgotten what the SH stands for, but...
P&O stood for Peninsula and Oriental Steam... Well, that may be the S.
But if you went out in a certain accommodation, it was called POSH, I think.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we shipped in there, and we cast anchor, I guess, at 3 o'clock that day, and within an hour, I guess, my mother, my brother, and I were seasick. Predictably.
Oh,
let me just see for a minute.
Here, I thought you were having a wonderful trip across the ocean, but it wasn't
so
wonderful.
Well, let's go on.
You don't remember it with too much pleasure, obviously.
Oh, look, everybody gets seasick when they first get on a boat, you know. I think in 24 hours the whole thing was over. I mean, any nausea was over in 24 hours.
Oh, didn't last the whole trip.
It's just,
then.
Just a matter of finding your sea legs, you know, when you get on a large ship.
So
but the weather, I remember the weather was pretty bad when we set sail, and I think it lasted for a day or so, and then cleared up, and just beautiful after that.
You went through the canal?
Yeah, the Port Said, of course, where that was the first stop, and at each stop there was a, of course, tour of the city with plenty of vendors, and those were the days when the, you know, a ship like that berthing was a relatively big occasion for the people there, and it was all a matter of great hospitality and a lot of friendship, unlike the world today.
Must have been terribly exciting for a little boy.
Well, it was. It was. Next stop was Aden. Then Colombo.
A lot of water between Aden and Colombo.
Yeah, well, like six days.
Mm-hmm.
6 days travel.
Pleasant weather at that time of year.
It was, although, you know, when you get pretty close to the equator, it doesn't matter what time
anywhere.
Of the year it is,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But in Colombo particularly, I still remember that very, very clearly, particularly this guide going up to a tree and cutting a curb in it and letting the sap fall out and then watching it solidify, and before you know it, they had this great big rubber band in his hand. rubber trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was all exciting. And then after Colombo, the next stop was Fremantle, Perth.
Mm-hmm.
Which again was, let's see. Oh, wow. That was 8. Seven days, a week straight sailing, and of course life on board was very pleasant because they had the, you know, the children, they had a special sort of children's playroom where the kids spent all day and they, under supervision, and they had organized games and swimming and partying and fancy dress parties and all that kind of stuff. It was very, very nicely done, and we'd go to bed, and my parents would go up on deck for the dinner and dancing, and come back pretty late.
I've forgotten. Fremantle has just one E,
F-R-E? Fremantle.
Okay.
Fremantle, and that was, because one thing one immediately had to recognize in those days, Australia had the White Australia policy.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing was a scrutiny and a medical examination. I think one of my first comments about Perth was that it wasn't that much different from a European city, and that's true. I mean, we didn't know what to expect in Australia, really, although we'd read books and so on, of course. But it was really, in retrospect, altogether a very, very easy country, a very easy place to get adjusted to. Adelaide and Melbourne, we did not go on shore because kids were not allowed because the danger of contracting measles. There are measles epidemics in those places, so no kids were allowed on shore. Then Burnie, which is on the north shore of Tasmania, as you know, and is still a sleepy little town today, as it was then. And I remember at Burnie looking out, we berthed very early, dawn was just breaking, and saw the stevedores with their hooks handling bales of wool, and they're all dressed in, you know, long pants, and then grey singlets, you know, and hats that I at first thought were cowboy hats, you know, broad-brimmed hats. And that was my first impression of Aussies as such.
I've been to Perth and Adelaide and Melbourne, but I've never been to Tasmania at all.
Very, very beautiful island, and in the winter, very cold and windy. The roaring 40s come through there.
I was thinking that's quite a voyage from Perth around through there, isn't it?
Well, from Perth, it's Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, then down to Burnie.
Oh, I see.
Across the Bass Strait, right? Across the Bass Strait where all the oil has been found. And then back up to Sydney from there.
And this, by now you're at the end of January.
Yeah, in fact into February by now. Still very, very hot, of course. Although, you know, I didn't really feel the heat in Sydney very much. And to be quite honest, Sydney and Melbourne in the summer, the course of a normal summer might have two or three really hot spells of a few days, but beyond that, not very oppressive. So we got to Sydney on the 10th of February, 1938, and went into a hotel, a Wentworth Hotel, of which there's still a successor in Sydney, but it was the very nice hotel in Sydney at that time. And I remarked on my first impression of Sydney, funnily enough, for one who'd never been to America, of course, I said it was totally Americanized. And I referred to the city as a mass of skyscrapers. And the tallest building was the Shell building there, which I guess must have been, 11 or 12 stories high. It was less than that, actually. I'd never seen a building that tall. Of course, to me, that was a skyscraper, well and truly. And there was the AWA, Australian Wireless Associated or something. They had a radio tower, which was the highest feature of the city. Both of those still exist, but of course they're dwarfed by the skyline of Sydney today. Well, the very next day we went starting to look at schools. I remember the first day we visited Scots College, and that made a average kind of impression on us, and the next day we went to Cranbrook, and we immediately liked Cranbrook, and that's where my brother and I went to school, and that's a big part of our formative years, of course, our subsequent schooling at Cranbrook. And then we did, of course, buy school uniforms. That was
of course, the school uniforms, which are gray suits, blue shirts, gray knee-length socks. We both wore shorts still at that time. Black shoes, and either school hats, the boaters, you know, mm-hmm. or caps, visor caps. Of course, the and this was already then barely after the beginning of the school year.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is February, 10th of February is usually the beginning of the academic year mm-hmm. there. And inevitably, the kids stared at us quite a bit as we entered school, because I suppose to their eyes we were dressed a bit funny. We weren't wearing our school we didn't have our school uniforms just yet. And our knowledge of English still left quite a lot to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd learned an awful lot on the ship. You know, what is it, 5 weeks or whatever? Let's see, it must have been 6 weeks, I guess, on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
We embarked
January 6th to February 10th.
Yeah.
Five and a half weeks.
At
that age, you can learn a lot of
language. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Especially, we made some very good friends.
Did you?
On the ship, particularly one gentleman, a Mr. Talbot Wilson from the Jersey Islands,
mm-hmm.
who really took a shine to my parents and myself. We corresponded with him afterwards, and he wrote down our birthdays. He used to send mm-hmm. us birthday presents.
Nice.
And he was one of those people who, you know, even a month before the war, wrote to us and told us that he was convinced there wouldn't be a war. Simply because he believed that, you know, the people didn't want it, only the politicians, and probably a lot of truth to that. But I, you know, as early as the 15th of February, already remarked that we were beginning to feel a little bit at home in school. So it wasn't an unhappy introduction at all.
Just a second.
Sure. Well, I don't have enough practice, but...
No, that's fine.
We have, one of the answering machines at home, and I sound like I have trouble with it.
Oh, no, it's coming through just fine.
Good. Well, again, Cranbrook, a boys' college, a member of what was called the Associated Schools in Sydney. There were six private schools in Sydney called the Associated Schools, as opposed to another association of schools which were called the great public schools.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't public, of course, they were private.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always intense rivalry between the great public schools and the associated schools.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say this about Cranbrook. Cranbrook then was about 20 years old.
Mm.
And it was on the grounds of the former Governor General's residence in South Wales. Beautiful grounds and a wonderful school oval, and then at the distance of about 2 miles, the playing fields. I've got a picture of it. I'll show you all of this. Yeah. And I guess the student body at that stage was maybe 400, something like that.
Mm.
And the headmaster was General Ivan Mackay, who later became, in the Second World War, Lieutenant General Sir Ivan Mackay, so-called Hero of Tobruk.
Mm.
an outstanding military man and a scholar, and a, you know, a thorough gentleman in every sense of the word. And he took a shine to my parents, and I think a little bit to us boys. And we always felt very comfortable with him, even though he was an extremely imposing presence. He went to war, I guess it must have been in 1941 or whatever. Yeah, about 1941, was replaced by another outstanding man, Brian Hone, H-O-N-E, who later became Sir Brian Hone, one of the outstanding educators in Australia. Came from Adelaide. When he came to Cranbrook, he had spent some years as headmaster of a private school in Britain. Being a Rhodes Scholar, of course, he was not only an outstanding scholar, but a tremendous cricketer and rugby union football player, too. And he, again, had a very great influence on my brother and myself. Mm-hmm. In schooling there. At Cranbrook, again, academic performance was stressed to the extent of frequent examinations, report cards, still corporal punishment for lapses in school discipline.
What form did this take?
Wax with a cane.
Hmm.
The old British system.
Where were you whacked?
On the behind. Now, mm-hmm. I will say this, that my brother and I, we weren't particularly goody-goodies or whatever, but we were never punished.
Mm-hmm.
You had to step out of line quite a bit to merit that kind of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Sports were... Hello? Yes, Tom. Fine.
Punishment.
Are we on?
Yes.
So that was the sort of academic side of it, but on the outside, sports, of course, compulsory, particularly cricket, football, that is rugby union. Later, towards the end of my studentship there, rowing, athletics, swimming, and physical training every day, sports three times a week, depending on the season, see. But everybody did those sports that I said, and there weren't alternatives.
No.
Everyone did all those sports.
Hmm.
And then teams were selected, of course, for external competition. But there was a lot of intramural competition, too. And all of a highly competitive nature, which, you know, I found suited my brother and me very well, because we enjoyed it from day one. Not that we were outstanding, but, you know, the competitive element of it really was very stimulating. So most days of the week, you'd start at 9 o'clock and not get home till 6
mm-hmm.
after sports, and then heavy load of homework, usually 2 or 3 hours homework mm-hmm. every night, 3 terms a year.
So your interest in sports isn't something that just came up recently
and
come full circle in a sense.
But we had been interested in, you know, even in Vienna we mm-hmm. were always interested in that.
But I say your interest now with the Olympics is kind of rounding that out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. in a way, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it was a fairly disciplined but very enjoyable kind of schooling, and you know, our first exposure to for instance cricket and football. I didn't know the first thing about that. And gradually, we got into it. I enjoyed cricket, but I must say I enjoyed football more. Mm-hmm. Rugby union is a little different from American football in that, you know, it's not essential to weigh 200 pounds and be fantastically fast. And this is jumping ahead of it, but the ideal position for me was what is the equivalent of quarterback.